And that would be Mr. Collins and Mr. Hatchett.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor.
And when you're ready, you may come forward, Mr. Collins. And just for a moment, sir, while we're waiting, do you want to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, 3 minutes, please.
Okay, certainly. As you know, each of you have 15 minutes and 3 minutes and just 1 moment, please. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Rick Collins. I represent Ms. Brown. This is a divorce case that had some years behind it when a divorce decree was finally entered following a trial where the court took evidence concerning equitable distribution. At the conclusion of the hearing, the court determined that it wasn't at a point where it felt it could make a decision with respect to equitable distribution due to the difficulty.
Didn't the bottom line whether or not the court retained in rem jurisdiction after the husband died?
I believe that is the issue. Whether that was the issue appears to be cast into doubt by the brief of the appellees. But I agree, the issue that was presented to the trial court, the issue that was presented in our opening brief is, did the court retain jurisdiction over equitable distribution after the husband died? I was unable to find a Virginia case that directly addresses that issue.
That's because there aren't any.
Yes.
we will concede that, sir.
Let me ask you a preliminary question here. I'm looking at the court's divorce decree, and he reschedules a hearing to present closing arguments regarding equitable distribution and to distribution of assets and such. But it's not completely clear to me from that order whether it's a final order or not, or whether it's just an interlocutory divorce decree with further consideration of the ED to be had at a later date. What's your position on the finality of that?
The order, the divorce decree is clearly not a final order. The court.
I'm sorry, what did you say?
The divorce decree is clearly not a final order with respect to any of the ancillary issues. I agree that there's case law that suggests.
But is it a final order for purposes of the divorce?
If a party wanted to challenge the granting of the divorce itself, meaning the actual divorce of the parties and the assignment of grounds, then I would agree that would be final with respect to.
For instance, your opponent is claiming that that there was not a proper reservation of equitable determination. And in order for him to raise that, he'd have to file it within 30 days of the final order that decided that issue. So that's why my question, yes. I raised the question of, was the decree actually a final divorce decree? Was your client married when the death occurred?
No, she clearly was not. She was divorced. And I think when the husband was alive and then his successors in this case, their issue would have been not only did they not challenge the bifurcation at the time, but they actually agreed to it. Everybody agreed to it. It just made sense under the circumstances.
There was no objection at trial to bifurcate, was there?
There was not.
It was an agreement by both counsel to bifurcate.
There was.
That's the question. Does paragraph 2 of that decree actually bifurcate? It doesn't use the language in the bifurcation statute, and it simply says it reserves final determination, which you can do without bifurcating.
Yes. It's certainly in substance bifurcation, and no one challenged it because at the time everybody was on board with this because we had a marital residence that was one of the major assets of the parties that had been on the market, was supposed to be relisted following the hearing, and as Judge Rizik had pointed out, said the extent to which that there's equity in this is a big assumption. At the time of the trial, we of course hoped there was equity, but as Judge Rizik pointed out, I think he used the phrase play money until someone actually buys it. So he divorced the parties. That was clear. VS-4 was entered. A divorce decree was entered. Everyone treated the parties as divorced because they were divorced. And then the case proceeded. Of course, unfortunately, Mr. Brown dies not long after the divorce decree was entered. And and I think the court now agrees, there are no Virginia cases directly on point, but we can, I think, I'd submit we can piece together what the Virginia law is on this subject from a few different opinions. The first and probably the primarily being the Sprouse v. Griffin case. Sprouse v. Griffin has some different facts, but the rules...
Those different facts are very important because Sprouse was decided based on the fact that the court had placed the property in a trust. Pending distribution, and the court said, having done that, we see no reason why the court couldn't continue to oversee the distribution of those assets.
Well, I would say that if our argument was that the court maintained jurisdiction because of placing in a trust, that would be a very important fact. But what Sprouse says is that the divorce abates when the decree is entered before a decree on the merits has been entered with respect to the marital status, and this obviously this was post-marriage. And so the case is not directly on point. There's some obviously some key differences. But even in the Forrest case, this court, it was in a footnote, but in the Forrest case, this court assumed the court continued to have jurisdiction because to enter a quadro when the divorce decree had been entered, but obviously the quadro was something that was post-death and post-decree. Even in the Craddock case, sorry.
Let me bring up, and I don't mean to cut you off. Let me bring up the issue of equity. The divorce court is a court of equity. There's no question about that. If your client, if the husband died while they were still married, she would be entitled to one half of his estate under the devise and descent statutes. If they weren't married, then the only way she could participate in the estate would be if the court retained jurisdiction over the marital estate and could divide it equitable distribution. Give me an argument on the equities of this. Why equity should rule in your favor as opposed to your opponent?
Well, I think Your Honor's statement highlights it. It's something an argument I had made to Judge Rizek, which is, the parties had this long-term marriage. They acquired certain assets and, unfortunately, some debts during the marriage. Prior to the divorce, my client would have had a right to a share of the augmented estate of her husband. The court changes their status by entering the divorce decree, and it's only equitable that court maintain jurisdiction to protect my client's rights to the marital assets that clearly had been accumulated post-decree and post the death of her husband. To do otherwise would have the court remove rights from her through an order and then in the same case not be able to address them. And so I certainly think it's an equitable argument, but I also think very clearly legally the law is, and is overwhelmingly the case in the other jurisdictions I cited, that when a divorce decree is entered and then a party dies post-decree, the court maintains jurisdiction over any ancillary issues, including equitable distribution. The Tucker v. Miller case, which is the North Carolina opinion, one of the ones I relied on in the brief, stated that it mentioned that North Carolina, like Virginia, has an equitable distribution statute that gives a party rights to property, and it says that once a court enters a decree, the claimant cannot be deprived of their right to equitable distribution, and that claim survives the death. That's exactly on point with this case. My client had equitable distribution rights to this case.
Are the statutes different because divorce is clearly... creature of statute?
They're not different in substance, at least on this issue. I can't claim that I'm an expert in North Carolina divorce law, but I think the reasoning of that opinion, where it talks about North Carolina, like Virginia, grants a party rights to equitable distribution, that the court certainly continues to have jurisdiction to protect that party's rights when a claim has been made. And I think it's really important in this case because my client was not the titled owner of two of the three largest assets in this case. The whole purpose of Virginia's equitable distribution statute is to recognize marriage as a financial partnership, and the titled owner of the property or the titled person who's liable for the debt does not control. And without an equitable distribution hearing, my client has no way of claiming her interest in, say, the North Carolina property that was at issue in this case or the husband's retirement account.
Well, counsel, when you researched, because you must have done like what we all did, we looked at all the states, and you know it's all across the board. It goes, there's not an overwhelming number of states that follow your example. But back to, you made the election, the council, the parties made the election for an equal distribution, and wouldn't your client's interest been better served to just have rather than have bifurcation for the equitable distribution, which you allege they still have the ability to do, wouldn't you have been better off to handle everything at once?
It would have been very difficult at that point, because if we go back to the point in time when that decision was made, this is following the trial, this is following the marital residence having been listed for sale without success for, I think, 3 to 4 years at that time. It was off the market, but the parties agreed it was going to be placed on the market. To use Judge Rizik's phrase, it was play money at that point. There was no way to say, Judge, my client's entitled to X, because we had no idea what was going to happen. Perhaps there would have been a liability from the residence. As it happens, the residence is teetering on the brink of foreclosure.
Once you make an election, once you make that election to, and you agree to bifurcation and set it over, are you making an election? In other words, just like anything else in life, the consequences can be good if the parties are leaving, or the consequences can cut against the grain and not in your favor.
I agree that election is made, and it was made, but I would say the election is made on the merits and not procedurally.
Don't you perhaps have an obligation to protect what assets there are? You're going to have a hard time if this goes back, I think, in collecting anything from the retirement account, the IRA, because of the terms of the account. If that's been paid over to the beneficiary of the account, you may have a hard time getting anything out of that. Aren't you required at that point to say, Judge, I want you to put all of these assets that we know about in escrow, and that way you clearly retain jurisdiction, and the trustee can't pay that money out to a beneficiary until further order of the court?
My answer to that is twofold.
Like Sprouse, which would have put you in the Sprouse situation.
Yes. Sprouse was different because the house had been sold, and they had to have some way of controlling assets. This house had not been sold, and in fact, there were orders indicating that if the house was sold, that the sales proceeds would have been held in escrow and with one or both of the attorneys in this case. But with respect to the individual retirement account, from a divorce perspective, there's no distinction between Megan Brown being the title owner now of the IRA versus Bruce Brown being the title owner of the IRA at the time of the trial. Either way, it's my client either has an equitable interest in the IRA or it doesn't, and certainly the court can look at whether that asset has been dissipated in determining what my client's share of that would be.
What jurisdiction does the court have over the beneficiary of the IRA, Megan Brown?
She was made a party to the case. It was an asset that's part of the divorce case, and it was preserved. Exhibits were entered during the divorce trial about what the nature of that asset were. Judge Rizik entered orders saying how that asset could be paid out while the case continued to be pending. And the court clearly has jurisdiction over the IRA.
Counsel, you're in rebuttal time. Do you wish to continue, or do you want to reserve it?
If there are no other questions on this issue, then I'd like to reserve my remaining time.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Philip Hatchett, and I represent Megan Brown individually and Megan Brown and Joshua Brown, co-executors of the Bruce Brown estate. I want to address something immediately from this. Under the order of March 2017, the wife was given notice that any asset that has designated beneficiary is going to, you lose control of that asset under 2111.1, and that is what happened. Husband made the beneficiary the child, Miss Megan Brown. There are many times, you all are trial court judges, where you have the parties say, put the assets into a trust, or have it designate beneficiary a special receiver, or have agree that if there is death was not contemplated.
Let's talk about, if I could for just a moment, I'll switch back to your argument. Do you agree that divorce decree was a final divorce decree?
I do, Your Honor. And
so if it is a final divorce decree, don't you have to challenge the bifurcation contained in that decree by appealing it within 30 days?
if I am challenging the divorce, I would have to have to make a challenge within 30 days. If you go to the Friedman case says that under 20107.3, if you are allowed to have bifurcation, and bifurcation requires two requirements, a motion and that there's clear necessity, then it creates somewhat two cases.
Mr. Hatcher, let me interrupt. You agreed to bifurcation, didn't you?
Well, I didn't agree to bifurcation because I represent the estate. But the
somebody in this universe agreed to bifurcation.
Yes, sir, and I didn't mean to be flippant. The circumstance was that at the time, in March or in November, when the judge said, I'm not ready to make the decision, I took great pains in putting it into the brief so that you get to see it. Yes. They then signed the order in March agreeing to bifurcate, for it to be bifurcated. But the court has the right to say, I made a mistake. And that's what this judge did.
But if you're correct, and this is where I was kind of heading, if you're correct that you don't have to appeal the bifurcation at the time of the entry of the divorce decree, at the time the decision is made, but you can appeal it once the bifurcation decision is finally carried out, you didn't assign cross error to the decision to bifurcate. You simply argued it. Doesn't that knock you out on appeal?
Let me see if I understand.
The rules require you to, as an appellee, to assign cross error to any decision the trial court made if you want to pursue that. You didn't assign cross error.
I didn't, with all due respect, I didn't have to. The judge ruled that there was he had no jurisdiction.
You didn't assign cross error in the appeal to his decision to bifurcate. You argued that the bifurcation was improper, but there's no assignment of error in your brief.
I agree that there's no assignment of error, but I don't believe I have to, because if you look at Christensen, everybody agrees here that this is the only way you can bifurcate is to go to the statute, 21007.3, and you have to meet the qualifications. Well, they didn't do that. And then Christensen says,
there's a concept on appeal called approbate and reprobate, and you can't complain on appeal what you agreed to below.
I didn't agree to it, Your Honor. I got into the estate, got into the case, and my whole days were 40 days. And I was allowed, look at the order that allows, it doesn't substitute parties, it adds them, with the permission to file any answer or responsive pleading. And Christensen says that 20107.3 forbids the court from retaining jurisdiction to make an equitable distribution award after the divorce had been granted without first finding clear necessity. Therefore, however, the statute does not prohibit the court from granting the divorce. In Christensen, they granted the divorce and said that they didn't have a right to equitable distribution. This is our situation. And then Mr. Brown dies. You have to go back and look at Sprouse. A divorce suit abates when one party dies while the suit is pending before a decree on the merits.
Sprouse says the divorce suit abates. That is the divorce, the decree of divorce, because God is rendered asunder, man doesn't have to anymore. It doesn't stand for the proposition that the court doesn't continue to have jurisdiction to deal with the real the race of the estate.
Well, and not until the change in the statute could you bifurcate. So it was not, Sprouse was not at that point, because that was decided 100 years ago. But going back to the point, I did not have to assign error. In fairness, the wife did not articulate why she was appealing this case. And saying that they did not have, that the court made a wrong decision, there's no court record of that hearing.
Let me read to you Rule 5A:21, which is the brief of the appellee, shall contain a statement of the case if the appellee disagrees with the statement presented by the appellant, and a statement of any additional assignments of error the appellee wishes to present, with a clear and exact reference to the page where they were preserved. You have to assign cross error to a decision of the court in order for it to be properly before us, or initiate a separate appeal on that issue. But we have a brief with a lot of argument, but no cross error.
Because of the order of February 14 is so brief. So limited, and it went in our favor, saying that I do not have jurisdiction. I don't have a cross appeal from that. I don't think that wife has made the met the requirement that she identify why she is what she has appealed from. Is it that 21073 applies or not?
In Friedman, I changed direction just a little bit. In Friedman, we held that the bifurcation essentially transforms one case into two. Correct?
Yes, sir.
Give me your equitable argument why the court should not retain jurisdiction to decide the distribution of the property in the second case that the bifurcation is created.
If you look at the case law and you look at the statute, when the divorce was entered, all parties were put on notice. Assets can be designated for beneficiaries. And at the time of the death, yes, the court case was continuing on. It should not have been. We highlighted it to the judge. Something's wrong here. You're not making, this is not a case that can go forward where you did not have the right authority to have bifurcation. And the court turned and said, we don't have jurisdiction. The equity is that at the time of the divorce, wife knew the assets, the North Carolina property. It's not in Virginia, not under the control, conflict of laws. The IRA. It says it in the code. You have to put it in bold that you can designate a beneficiary. And she took no action to protect it.
Here's my problem. You know, I said this earlier. If he dies prior to the divorce decree being entered, wife can share in this case one half of his estate if she's cut out of the will. But your argument is, but if she dies, or if he dies after the divorce decree is entered, it's just tough luck. She didn't get anything. And that, to me, the equities just don't seem to be there. And this isn't an equitable distribution case.
In fairness to the husband, this is a case where the court has jurisdiction only by statute.
That's correct.
And it was not anticipated that anybody would die.
And it never is. And that's the problem we've got with these cases.
And then you have to go back to the core. And the core is, in divorce, when someone dies, it is over.
But you say it's a creature statute, which I agree with completely, but the statute says, upon the entry of the decree of divorce, the court shall determine the legal title and distribute it. Shall, not may.
Yes, but you have to fold that into the Christensen case. And look at what it says. There are three cases that this court has looked at on 107.3. Erickson, Dixon. And it says that we are only allowing the court to have limited jurisdiction. The court said the General Assembly limited the power and jurisdiction of divorce courts and to prohibit circuit courts from separately adjudicating divorce and equitable distribution except when two, at that time, were two prerequisites, which the legislators imposed, have been met.
But you agree, do you not, that up until, at least up until the time the husband died, the court had jurisdiction, right?
Yes, sir.
So where do I go to find something that specifically tells me that upon the husband's death, the court loses jurisdiction over the estate?
The new party went to the court and said, "Your Honor, you made a mistake. You don't have jurisdiction," and the court agreed. And the court can change its mind, and did. And the consequences are severe. But there were so many things that she could have done to protect her interest. She could have asked for a constructive trust.
But that wouldn't have helped if the court lost jurisdiction.
Oh, yes.
What are you talking about? Under Sprouse.
Yeah. My favorite case.
Well, except Sprouse tells me that the court does retain some jurisdiction to equitably divide the property.
Had the proper steps been put in, and she was on notice of that, and she didn't do it. And she didn't preserve this. And look at I'm sorry, Your Honor.
What bothers me about this case is that the husband's counsel agreed to bifurcation. He dies, now the estate says you're not bound by his agreement. Is that correct?
What I think is the better logic here on this is, Judge, there was a look back, there was a mistake made. And the court doesn't disagree with me that this was continued by convenience by the circuit court judge. He was not ready to move. Parties had rested.
But forget about the estate for a minute. If his counsel agreed to a certain action, he's bound by that. Now,
until corrected by the judge.
Now the estate comes back and says that we're not bound by that agreement.
It went to the court and said, basically rehear it to see, yes. But the court has already, here today, Judge Petty has already mentioned, how are you going to put the toothpaste back in the tube? You've allowed the beneficiary, without any hesitancy, the beneficiary of the IRA, to have it. How is this court going to have jurisdiction over the North Carolina property after the death?
But my problem with that argument, and I agree that that is an issue, but the opinion that we write is going to be one that doesn't just apply to this case, but applies to other cases. And I could see a case coming up where the property is clearly capable of distribution. You know, a multi-million-dollar estate involving lots of real property that is still there. So I don't see how we can decide it just on the basis of the IRA having already been distributed.
Well, I think that with all due respect, I think you have to stay within the parameters of where the law is now. And if you grant and overturn this, you are overturning Christensen. You are overturning Erickson Dixon, and I agree that husband agreed to the bifurcation one time, but then the court reviewed and has the right to do that. That's not an issue Nobody questions that.
If there are no other questions, thank you, Mr. Hanifield. Mr. Collins, you have 2 minutes and 20 seconds, but I'm going to enlarge that because we allow Mr. Hatchett to run over as well, so I'm going to enlarge it to give you that for an additional minute.
Okay, thank you.
Counsel, when the trial court ultimately found it had no jurisdiction, was it had anything to do with whether or not there was bifurcation, or simply that he died?
No, thank you. That was the first point I was going to make in rebuttal. The only issue that was presented to the trial court related to jurisdiction was the husband's death. This came both from my argument. I filed a memorandum of law shortly after his death, and then I attached the memorandum of law to my response to the estate's motion to dismiss. The estate's motion to dismiss had nothing to do with bifurcation. I cited this in my reply brief. From the memorandum of law, it was Megan Brown's memorandum of law framed the issue as, does the court continue to have jurisdiction to determine and order equitable distribution after the death of one of the parties, Bruce S. Brown? In the co-administrator's motion to dismiss, they further stated that the matter terminated by operation of law at the death of one of the parties, Bruce S. Brown. The estate and Megan Brown filed a motions to dismiss each of them. They filed a memorandum of law in support of the motion to dismiss. We had extensive argument before the court on the motion to dismiss, and at no point was bifurcation raised. The first time bifurcation was challenged was in the brief of the appellees. That was the first time. The trial court never was given an opportunity to expand upon its reasoning, nor were we given an opportunity to elicit more testimony about that, and that clearly has not been preserved. And this is in contrast, with the Christensen case, where there was a timely objection made to bifurcation. And
well, over and above it, the trial court, what's your position on whether Rule 5A21 requires an appellee to assign cross error in order to preserve the argument before this court?
Yeah, I think that it does, but I also wanted to address the merits of it in case we got past that point. And also Erickson-Dixon, it pointed out issues of the bifurcation in Erickson-Dixon, but it also pointed out that it had gone unchallenged, and that when the court continued to act unchallenged, even if it was faulty, that it maintained jurisdiction to bifurcate, and that's an important distinction between the Christensen case. But again, Christensen had a timely objection at the time of bifurcation. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Collins. We'll come down and greet counsel. Thank you.